Previously on Beta.
Of course. The only one in my family who believes in me is the dead one.
I intend to inject a 2% cocaine solution directly into Mr. Gentile's spinal canal.
Well, we take a variety of factors into account in the loan approval process.
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Today, Dana Schwartz joins us to talk about her historical young adult novel, Anatomy, a Love Story. The book explores the early days of medical history in 19th century Scotland.
I had a Q&A where someone asked me whether I would ever write an adult version of Anatomy, and I was like, this is the adult version. I just wrote it exactly the way I wanted to write it.
Also, Jason Mott on the unplanned success of his novel, Hell of a Book, which won the National Book Award for Fiction.
And I was just letting myself be creative. And then all of a sudden, you know, this kid shows up and the kid starts talking to the author. And I was like, well, let's just see where this goes. And it went and kept going and turned into a big pivotal part of the novel.
But first,
how about we get him a real attorney, man? What the hell is this? This is who he hires?
What? Are you kidding me? This is the guy you want. This is the guy I'd hire.
Oh, it's the guy you'd hire.
Dudes like Houdini. Seriously, when the going gets tough, you don't want a criminal lawyer, right? You want a criminal lawyer. Know what I'm saying?
That's a clip from AMC's Breaking Bad. It was how the world first learned of the amoral lawyer, Saul Goodman, played by Bob Odenkirk. And it wouldn't be the last. Bob has become synonymous with Saul, also known as Jimmy McGill, through the entire run of Breaking Bad and the prequel follow-up, Better Call Saul. Before that, Bob enjoyed a chameleon-esque career. He was a journeyman sketch comedy writer for Second City, Saturday Night Live, and The Ben Stiller Show. He then went on to co-create and co-star in the groundbreaking HBO sketch comedy series, Mr. Show with Bob and David. Bob writes about his incredible career in a memoir called Comedy, 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 Drama. Now, with his feature film Nobody, I'm betting that the paperback version's title will be Comedy, 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 Drama, Action. He joined us via Zoom from his home in Los Angeles to talk about his journey from Mr. Show to Saul Goodman and his lone legacy sketch for Saturday Night Live.
I had been at Second City doing one-man show in the ETC theater thanks to the kindness and generosity of Joyce Sloan, a famous den mother of Second City. And so they knew me there. And of course, all the people that I'd started with, in particular, Dave Pasquese and Holly Wartell and Jill Talley, were in the main stage company. So they'd kind of risen up through the ranks, and I had left, gone to Saturday Night Live, then invited back. Chris Farley was invited in, also abruptly, not really going through the program, but he was so funny, so undeniable. And then one night he was improvising, playing a coach, and we were doing an anti-drug improvised speech to a bunch of high schoolers. And that character, the way he moved, the things he talked about, it just stuck in my head. And I went home and that night sat alone and wrote on a legal pad the sketch, the motivational speaker. And I've probably written, you know, a couple thousand sketches in my life. And only a few of them did I write exactly the way they were played.
Now I wonder, Brian, from what I've heard, you're using your paper not for writing, but for rolling doobies. You're gonna be doing a lot of doobie rolling when you're living in a van down by the river.
I will note, when we got to Saturday Night Live, at the end of the sketch, we did not do this at Second City, at the end of the sketch, Robert Smigel said, have him break the table.
Oh, Matt's gonna be your shadow. Here's you, here's Matt. There's you, there. Whoops-a-daisy.
And so I did not write the breaking the table, which was so funny and so such a capper to the sketch. That's Robert Smigel.
You won an Emmy for your work on SNL and on The Ben Stiller Show, but you really came into your own when you joined forces with David Cross to create your HBO sketch comedy series, Mr. Show with Bob and David. What did you want to accomplish with Mr. Show?
Yeah, I kind of felt like I was done with sketch after The Ben Stiller Show. I mean, it feels like it's a young man's game and you have to move on into more storytelling and investment in character. So I was unhappily willing to do that. I did enjoy The Ben Stiller Show a lot, and I had a great deal of freedom there. But that show was very focused on mashing up pop culture things, and I still felt that I wanted to do just a very pure sketch show. And basically, I figured I missed my chance, and that was too bad. But then I met the young, sprightly fellow by the name of David Cross, a troublesome, angry, anarchic, very funny, very smart person who also wanted to make a sketch show with all the same attributes that I was after, kind of mixing in absurdity, moving from one sketch to the other without breaking, without stopping down, and a kind of an angry kind of social commentary, but hopefully interpreted a bit. So it's more than just the news of the week.
That's what this week's show is about.
Yeah, but I'm watching the show right now.
Idiots! It's simple! Look at this! This is what's airing right now, the pet care
Please,
show! Listen,
I'm
talking
oh
about
God,
pets!
Stop calling about racism! We did that a week ago! Look here!
Listen to me for the last time. Crime on the streets happened last week. Everything I'm saying happened last week. Look here! And that concludes our first show, Crime in the Streets. I can't help but think it would have gone a little better had somebody actually called in, but I guess that's because you won't see me until next week. Oh well, as soon as we get the kinks worked out here, I'm sure it's going to be a great, great show.
When it came to comedy, when it came to writing those sketches, we were on the same page. We both were pursuing a degree of excellence in the writing, a clarity in the writing, and kind of a smartness and a surprising quality so that the sketch didn't get dragged down into a repetitive beat. So it was very interesting because we did then, and I think continue to, we're going to start a new project soon, continue to write really well together without one or the other of us doing any one job exclusively. Sometimes David is reining me in. Sometimes he's adding structure. More often, but only slightly, I'm adding structure and I'm trying to clarify his ideas. But we really balance each other out so well and without any real effort to do so.
Well, what do you think is the legacy of Mr. Show with Bob and David?
Well, mostly the legacy is some part of my soul is at peace. It didn't do great in the ratings. It did do great on DVD. Do you know? It was in the top five sellers for like weeks when it first went out on DVD. And the funny thing, the reason I bring it up is because I remember an HBO executive, when we said, can you please put it on video, basically said, why? Nobody's going to buy it. But that was back when people thought nobody's going to buy a TV show on DVD or video. Why would they ever buy it? It's a TV show. And we proved him wrong because he couldn't believe it, this executive, when they finally did make the DVD and it sold really well. The legacy is that a bunch of young people saw it and they were inspired to try sketch comedy and improvisation and writing.
Bro, I never did catch your name.
Saul.
Saul?
Saul Good, man. Get it?
I do. All right, Saul.
In January of 2009, you were working on some projects when you got a call from your agent. He was pitching you this role as a lawyer for a drama called Breaking Bad. What did you see in this character that made you to decide to accept the role?
Okay, well, first of all, I was in a financial strain at that point, and I would have said yes to any work because my business manager told me, just say yes to everything. I had a good business manager. He's a good man, and his point was a good one. Just make money, which I needed to do. Okay, leaving that aside, my agent did say, They're going to offer you a role. Do not say no to this one. I think he didn't get the memo that I was in financial strain. He was afraid I was going to say no. Now, listen, I did check into it before I said yes. I called a friend of mine, Reed Harrison. He and I were working on a project at that moment. Not many people had seen Breaking Bad. It was not a success. This was the second season, just starting, actually halfway through shooting. The first season was cut short by a writer's strike. It was only 7 episodes long, and very few people had seen it. I had seen only the billboards. I called my friend. I said, "What do you know about the show Breaking Bad?" And he said, "That is the best show on TV. I love it. Oh my God, you have to do that role." So I was going to say yes. It meant something to me that my friend loved it. I talked to Vince Gilligan. He said, "You're a sleazy bus stop bench ad lawyer." And I said, "I have an idea for him right away. I have this comb over with a mullet in back." And he goes, "Great, that'll be great," which is kind of amazing because he's a man of details. And the fact is, I hadn't read the script. I hadn't even seen the show. And I just threw this idea out, and he loved it right away.
I'll tell you one thing, you've got the right product. Anything that gets the DEA's panties in this big a bunch, you're on to something special. And I would like to be a small and silent part of it. Food for thought, yeah? So if you want to make more money and keep the money that you make, better call Saul.
And I only made one or two notes, and I thought, this is a different show. This is a drama. This is an opportunity to act, to not just do a performance that is kind of half me, half comic character, but to really lose myself in a person written by someone else that I don't really know, a different, very different from myself. So I was just about to make another note and, you know, thinking about making the phone call and saying, "Hey guys, I got some ideas." And I thought, you know what? I don't think a real actor does this. I think a real actor does the script as written. I think they learn the lines. It occurred to me quickly that because Saul is scripted, speaks so differently from me, it would just make it a more unique person to play if he was literally speaking in cadences and terminology that I would never use. So I didn't write that note. I didn't ask for changes. I learned it pretty much to the comma, and I continued to do that all through Better Call Saul.
A couple of months after Breaking Bad wrapped, the show's creator, Vince Gilligan, and writer Peter Gould pitched the spinoff, Better Call Saul, to you. How did you react?
Well, they'd talked about it as a joke over the years. I took it as a joke, only Vince kind of made it sound realistic. He would say, "I think there's a story there. I think there's something to say about that guy." And I would always say, "Well, I don't know. If you think so, then maybe." So here we were at the Chateau Marmont, and they'd asked for this lunch. And it was, I think Breaking Bad was maybe almost a year behind us, but maybe only a few months, 6 months or so. And they said, "We think there's a show in Saul." So I said, "You know, look, guys, you have to make him likable, because I don't think he's likable outside of the milieu of Breaking Bad."
And here I thought all lawyers were idiots.
No, only half of us are idiots. The other half are crooks.
Aren't you a spicy one?
Well,
if I were 40 years younger, I'd have you buy me a piña colada.
Well, if you want me to draw up a DNR, I'll bring a blender and some pineapple.
I knew I'd like you when I saw how you saved that poor man on the television.
Well,
Moxie is in such short supply these days.
Yeah, well, I pride myself on my Moxie. I said, "If you're going to write about him, here's one thing I think I know about the character. I think he's really likable if he's in a lot of trouble. Physical trouble is great with Saul. If he's hurt physically in his escapades, he becomes particularly likable, and there's some insight into him in those moments, I feel. He's disarmed in a way, And it's a good thing because I feel like the audience sees that guy for the stumbling human that he is in those moments when he's genuinely stumbling. And so I said, I hope if you do write this show, you'll write a lot of that. And they did.
Yeah.
I wish I could tell you about the final season because that note that I just told you, they carry it through the whole final season.
We'll look forward to it then. What is different about the way you played Jimmy McGill versus the way you portrayed Saul Goodman?
Well, what I love about playing the Jimmy Saul Gene Takovic, that's when he's in hiding in the Cinnabon, is I do think we all have some version of that. You know, we have some version of the public persona. Maybe we're a little more strong-willed. We throw our opinion around a little louder. Then there's the family version of ourselves where we're talking to our spouse and maybe our kids. And then there's the version where you're alone. And we see that somewhat too in Better Call Saul. And when you're alone, you're yet another version of yourself. Maybe that's the place where you most are vulnerable and let out, feel your self-doubt. And so I get to play all those things in Better Call Saul. I'm extremely lucky.
And you play them, well, they're extremely lucky that they went ahead and did it because you do it so well. You recently made an action movie called Nobody, and this is quite a pivot for you. Why did you want to make an action film?
Well, probably because you asked me that question, and I am tickled by the idea that I did it and pulled it off. And I'm tickled by it's so crazy. It's so crazy that I would do an unironic, vengeance-filled, anger-filled action movie.
Come on, you gotta give me something.
I will. But not now. I need to take care of this.
What is this?
It is what it is. This is me. Becca, I love you, but I need you to trust me right now. Okay, blind for the last time. I promise.
There are so many reasons why I approached that project, which was written for me based on my own inspiration of inspired by life events where my family was experienced a break-in that was very traumatic for us. And I was left with a lot of feelings of anger that didn't go away very readily or really for a long time. And I thought I could use those feelings to power this performance. I also thought on Saul, I got to play this non-ironic, earnest, intense feeling. And I found it rewarding to go there. It's the most rewarding thing about acting, drama acting, to me. And I thought we could dig into that stuff and use it. And I thought I could get in shape because I'd have to do the stunts. And that would be an interesting and good thing for a 54-year-old when I started it. I shot it at 57. It was a real challenge in so many ways. And I wanted that challenge. And I also thought it would never get made.
You've been a comedy writer, a comedic actor, a dramatic actor, an action hero. What's next for Bob Odenkirk?
I gotta go to sleep for a couple of years. Rip Van Winkle time.
Yeah. But possibly maybe Nobody 2, right? A sequel?
Yeah, and also, we're trying to make it happen. And we're trying to achieve something of the same vibe of the first film where you really feel and know, you feel like you know the family and you know the tensions within the family. And then once it starts going, it becomes a fantasy.
Bob Odenkirk, thank you very much for joining us today. Congratulations on comedy, drama. And I'm so pleased for you that everything's coming up Odenkirk, and I hope that continues.
Thanks so much.
Bob Odenkirk is the author of Comedy, Drama. You can find out more about Bob and his incredible career at WPR.org/beta.
I was trying to point out or make fun of the people who profit without scientific reason, but no, that was a thing that I did change because I didn't want people to think this was a political point that I was making.
Coming up, Dana Schwartz joins us to talk about her historical novel, Anatomy, a Love Story.
I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Dana Schwartz is the second member of the Beta Three Timers Club. This is a club that expresses our appreciation for guests making their third appearance on our show. Since she last joined us, Dana's podcast, Noble Blood, about some of history's most tragic stories, has blown up. History is still on her mind. Her young adult novel, Anatomy, a love story, is a Shelley-esque nod to gothic tales complete with grave robbing and shady medicine. The story is set in Edinburgh, Scotland, in the early 1800s, during the infancy of medical history. Hazel Sinnott is an independent young woman who yearns to be a surgeon but runs up against the sexism of the era. We caught up with Dana and she told us why she wanted to write Anatomy.
You know, I've been fascinated with sort of the macabre side of medical history my entire life, just the dawn of pre-anesthesia surgery and how kind of gruesome it was. But there's also this something sort of romantic about the Enlightenment side of it and the dawn of modern scientific reason coming to the forefront. So I've always sort of had that churning around in the back of my mind. And when I was 22, I went to Edinburgh for the first time. As an American, I feel like it was exactly what I had always envisioned of a European city, that castle on a hill and these cobblestone streets. And so I had those pieces rattling around in my brain for a long time. And then Anatomy was just the book that I was desperate to write.
How much of an influence was your history podcast, Noble Blood, on Anatomy?
You know, a fairly big influence, even though Noble Blood is all true and all fully researched and is only about Noble, so I haven't really talked about any of the surgical figures that I had to research for this book. But I will say, over the 2+ years of writing scripts for Noble Blood, I got very confident at writing in a period. And I think I wouldn't have been as comfortable writing in the early 1800s had I not already had a lot of practice doing it. Noble Blood, even though it wasn't a direct influence in terms of research, gave me that boost of confidence. And I think probably was a good transition in terms of the sort of public persona I put out as a writer. Like, in my head, I've always been sort of this, like, you know, spooky historical writer, because that's always the things that I'm interested in. But I think that maybe audiences might have been expecting something funnier or snarkier. And so I think Noble Blood was a good halfway point of people to realize that I'm really interested in history and writing things that aren't necessarily Twitter ready.
Mm, yeah, very well said. Yeah. Anatomy is being marketed as a young adult novel. And as an old adult, I have to say that I really enjoyed reading it. When you started writing it, did you feel like you were writing a novel for young people?
You know, that's so funny that you say that, because I do really feel like things that are quote unquote young adult novels really become something of marketing decisions. I found that the young adult market at this point in time is more willing to accept books that are mixes of genre without it being sort of relegated to the science fiction fantasy section of a bookstore. I always wanted Anatomy to be a little gory and a little science fiction-y in the way that Frankenstein was. And I found that young adult publishing was just a place where readers were willing to accept that. It's so funny that you say that, because I've been doing virtual events for this book to promote it. And in one, I had a Q&A where someone asked me whether I would ever write an adult version of Anatomy. And I was like, this is the adult version. I just wrote it exactly the way I wanted to write it. And the reason I think it's a young adult book is because it's about a person who's 17, who's at the precipice of the rest of their lives. And I'm very always heartened when adults are willing to recognize that just because something is called a young adult novel doesn't mean that it's only for young adults.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Your protagonist is Hazel Sinnott, who is living in Edinburgh, Scotland in 1817. You've created a strong, independent woman who is really a pioneer of feminism. How did you develop the character?
You know, I really wanted to make Hazel feel like a woman of her time, even though she is a strong woman who's more ambitious and pursuing a path that wouldn't have been considered socially acceptable for a woman at the time. It was really important to me that she still feel very grounded and not like a 2022-year like protagonist who had just been dropped into the 1800s. So I sort of had to work backwards. I was like, what type of girl who existed in this era would be able to sort of see herself as a surgeon when she doesn't really have role models? And so I worked backwards thinking, all right, this is someone who sort of sees marriage as a foregone conclusion. She's been, you know, engaged to her cousin her entire life. She just doesn't really see the necessity of finding a husband. She's someone who's incredibly privileged because she grew up wealthy. And she's also someone who grew up very isolated. Her mother sort of became a little reclusive after the death of her older brother, and her father's gone. And so Hazel sort of has grown up very lonely and isolated. And so she has this sort of the naivete that comes from privilege, where she sort of thinks like, well, yeah, of course, why couldn't I do these things that I want to do? Because she hasn't had like the reinforcement of society knocking her down again and again.
Yeah, yeah. Your other main character is Jack Currer, and he's a resurrection man. What is a resurrection man?
So this is a very real job that existed at the dawn of the 1800s. This was a period where there was no system of donating one's body to science, and it was considered, you know, very sacrilegious to desecrate a corpse. And so no one was going to willingly have their body dissected by doctors. But this was the dawn of Enlightenment era science, when doctors needed to learn about the human body through dissection and study. And so an incredibly lucrative profession sprung up of people called resurrectionists or resurrection men, who dug up dead bodies and sold them to doctors who could dissect and study them. And so whereas Hazel is a character who is incredibly privileged and naive because of it, Jack is the opposite side of that. He's someone who has only existed as having already fallen through the cracks and understands the challenges of reality in a way that Hazel doesn't yet. And so they have a little bit of this uneasy alliance and partnership when he's able to teach Hazel how to get bodies and she's able to pay him. And then it, I don't think it's a spoiler to say, blooms into a little bit of a romance.
Yeah, yeah. There's an epidemic of Roman fever running rampant in anatomy. It's killed thousands of people. And I couldn't help but think of the coronavirus while reading your book. Was the pandemic on your mind while you were writing?
Oh, gosh. If you could imagine, I conceived of and began writing this book in 2019, before we had even heard of coronavirus, because I wanted to basically write about cholera and diphtheria. There were, if you can imagine, a number of illnesses and diseases going around in the 1800s in Scotland, but I wanted to condense and fictionalize them all into sort of one dramatic disease for dramatic purposes, because I think having the specter of one illness is more dramatic than the thought of, well, it could be typhus, it could be cholera, it could be diphtheria or a number of other things. But no, it was a very strange experience to be writing about sort of the fear and loneliness of a pandemic that hit rich people and poor people, and then have an actual pandemic hit us in a way that I absolutely could not have expected.
Mm-hmm. And I read somewhere that you, in the original version, the original draft of the novel, you had a character who was selling a cure for the plague that turned
out
to be a sham.
That was actually one of the first changes I made because of the real coronavirus and because of real people who are believe the conspiracy theories and are hesitant to get vaccines that are proven safe and effective by actual scientists. I had a character who was something of a snake oil salesman and revealing that they were willing to continue to sell this cure even though it had detrimental effects. And I removed that from the book because I didn't want, my worst nightmare would be someone thinking that I was sending any message that I didn't believe actual modern day science and scientists when I am a huge fan and supporter of science. And it was, I was trying to point out or make fun of the people who profit without scientific reason. But no, that was a thing that I did change because I didn't want people to think this was a political point that I was making.
Mm-hmm. You covered this a bit earlier, but I want to dig a little deeper, if no pun intended, about the early history of medical history and surgery that you find so fascinating. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah. So this was an era, if you can imagine, before anesthesia, when doctors had just sort of crossed the precipice of understanding really how the human body works in an empirical way. And Edinburgh was the heart and center of that enlightenment dawn of surgery. There were professors teaching, well, surgeons really, who would be doing surgery in basically amphitheaters with audiences, people desperate to see inside human bodies and learn how people worked. And I think it's just incredibly fascinating to imagine a period where the inner working of the human body was the frontier of science. In order to research this book, I did a lot of research on the surgeon Robert Lister, who was a surgeon in Scotland around that time. And he was one of the biggest inspirations for both Hazel's early experience, but also the character of Dr. Beecham in the book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you must have done a lot of research, right? You must have spent a lot of time researching.
Yeah, I researched Dr. Lister, who's the father of modern antiseptic technology, Dr. Liston, who was considered one of the fastest and most bombastic surgeons of the era, and Dr. Mutter, who actually is an American surgeon who studied in Paris, not Edinburgh, but who opened the Mutter Museum in Philadelphia. So if anyone is listening and has been to the Mutter Museum in Philadelphia, it's sort of his treasure trove of strange and grotesque body parts that he collected over his long career. I think from working so much on the Noble Blood podcast, I've gotten really a love for historical research. But the fun thing about anatomy is, because it is a novel and it's fictional, you know, I took what I wanted and fictionalized what I wanted to be a little more dramatic.
Mm-hmm. You really stuck the landing with the ending of Anatomy. It's very powerful, and I did not see it coming. I'm always curious about this. Did you know what the ending was before you started writing, or did it come to you as you were writing?
I did. I had this idea inspired by Frankenstein, the idea of putting together a human body and what that technology would look like. Basically, if Frankenstein technology existed and was real, what other applications could it have, and how might someone have discovered it in a different way with a different goal? And I did have the ending, and then it was a fun journey getting there. I always wanted it to be a twist, and I always wanted Hazel and Jack to end the way that they ended.
Mm. Reese Witherspoon chose Anatomy for her YA book club, and that makes me wonder if there might be a streaming or a film adaptation in the works. Is that a possibility?
I hope so. I've had some experience writing for television, and I would love the chance to turn Anatomy into a television show or film. I think it was a very fun world to write in, and a very fun period and setting for me, and I think it would translate really well to the screen.
I think so, too, and it's very cinematic, and the way you write, you have a lot of descriptions, so it's very cinematic, so you can just really imagine it as a film as you're reading it. Dana Schwartz, thank you very much for joining us today, and congratulations on Anatomy, a Love Story. It's always great to talk to you.
Thank you so much. This is such a pleasure.
Dana Schwartz is the author of the novel Anatomy, a Love Story. Find out more about Dana and her novel at wpr.org/beta.
And it was this period of almost every day there was a report of a new shooting. I had set up a Google Alerts at one point to try to keep track of things, and it started flooding my email box.
Coming up, Jason Mott joins us to talk about his novel, Hell of a Book, the winner of the National Book Award for Fiction. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.
I can hardly process it all. I can still remember when my folks had this talk, the talk, with me. The old man was on the edge of breaking into tears, and my mother was on the edge of rage. They both, in their own way, felt like they'd failed me. Maybe they thought they could do something about the world before I got old enough to be affected by it. But they had lied to themselves. They had ignored the fact that from the moment I came out with all this black skin, the world was already turning its blades against me. The traps had already been set. The walls had already been built. The schools, the prisons, the self-hatred. It had all been done before I ever showed up, and my parents had the audacity to think that they'd stood a chance against any of it. They dared to believe that they could change anything.
That's Jason Mott reading an excerpt from his National Book Award-winning novel, Hell of a Book. The novel follows an unnamed black author who goes on a publicity tour across the country to promote his best-selling novel. The book also tells the story of a young black boy named Soot who lives in a rural town in the not-too-distant past, and a character known as the Kid, who might be imaginary. Hell of a Book combines elements of noir, tragedy, and playfulness. Jason joined us to explain how that came about and why he decided to write Hell of a Book.
Largely just for the fun of it, I really enjoy stories that work outside the standard kind of confines of storytelling. Don't get me wrong, like I really enjoy a very normal, straight A to B to C kind of storytelling. But the ones that I always come back to me in my memory are the ones that do things very differently and have these kind of creative flourishes. And so after my first three novels, which are all very, I would argue, very standard and straightforward, I had been just itching to write in that kind of creative way that I always loved. When I was younger in undergrad writing fiction, I did a lot of really unique, creative, strange stories and kind of got away from that. And I wanted to go back to that. I was out of contract. There was no one expecting this novel. It was just me and the page having fun.
Mm-hmm. I've read that Hell of a Book allowed you to play with language in a way that you hadn't been able to before. And what you were just talking about, can you elaborate a bit, though, on what you were doing differently with the language?
It was closer to my own voice than I think most things that I've written. When you're a younger writer, there are so many people that you admire, and you oftentimes spend a lot of your writing career like not in so much trying to copy them, but you're trying to write in a way that like those authors would be proud of you. It's almost like you want to kind of do things in the spirit of how they did them. That worked for me for quite a while. But with this one, it was a novel that I wrote for myself. And the flourishes and the fun and the silliness and then also the heaviness and the exactitude of the language and using film noir as like a mechanic to tell the story about Black America, like those are all things that I personally just wanted to do because it was fun and challenging, and I really enjoyed those sections.
Mm-hmm. And so that probably added to your surprise that you mentioned earlier when you actually won the National Book Award, because as you say, it was a book you wrote for yourself.
Yes. This entire experience has been very shocking to me. When I was in the writing process, like before my agent saw it, before anyone really saw it, I was talking to a friend about the book, and she had not read the book at all. But I told her, I said, I don't think anyone's going to want to buy this book except for, I think this book is just for me, because I said, it's a very confusing book. It's doing 17 different things. It's got film noir. It's got Nick Cage. It's got, shootings and murders and police violence. It's got frenetic, weird sex scenes happening. Like I said, it's just a hodgepodge of all these things that I think I'm the only person that's going to understand what's going on here. Mm-hmm. And so it was a book that I really did not expect anyone to like or connect with, but it was something that I had so much fun. And it was very difficult at times to write as well. I don't want to like slip past that. It was definitely some of the most demanding emotional and creative writing I've done.
You never actually reveal the name of the narrator. Why?
So there was a draft of this story in which the narrator did have a name, and almost immediately from the time I gave him a name, I recognized it was a big mistake, and I took it out and just never looked back, because so much of the novel is trying to dance this line between this very personal, specific experience that the author is having, that only the author could have, the publishing industry, all this unique specificity to this person. And yet it also is trying to tell this universal story of the Black experience in America. when I gave the narrator a specific voice, it made him too specific. It took away that ability to become any person in any kind of, you know, just that anonymity that I wanted him to have. Because it is a story that wants to talk about the specific and the general at the same exact time. And that's a really difficult thing to do. And that specific name just took that away.
I see. Yeah, that makes total sense. That never occurred to me. But yeah, I think you were right to do that. Besides the narrator, there are also two other very important characters in Hell of a Book, Soot and the Kid. Can you tell us about them?
So those are two characters that kind of emerged. And again, they're also characters who don't really have names. Obviously, the Kid is, that's the title that he gets christened by the author. And Soot is the title, I mean, that's the name the bullies gave him. So we never find out the names of any of these main characters. But they emerge. So the Soot character happened when I was in this phase of before it was a novel. I was just writing these experiences about my thoughts and feelings about being Black and some of my personal memories about growing up. And it was just this hodgepodge of things, some of them real, some of them imagined, some of them kind of taken from the news. But it was a story of like youth and this kind of coming of age and like what it meant to be a parent to a child to a minority child and all these kinds of things. And so Soot kind of grew out of that. The Kid, weirdly enough, and just make people question my mental state sometimes, the Kid just kind of appeared one day, just almost as he does in the novel. I was revising the scenes with the author because the scenes with the author were written first. Like that whole narrative of the author on book tour was written first. And I was going back in and I was doing some work on that. And I was just letting myself be creative. And then all of a sudden, you know, this kid shows up. And the kid starts talking to the author. And I was like, well, let's just see where this goes. And it went and kept going and turned into a big pivotal part of the novel.
Yeah, definitely. One of the most powerful storylines in your book is the tragic police shooting of a young Black boy. The shooting airs repeatedly on the news, so it's a kind of a recurring motif. How difficult was it for you to write these scenes?
Those were some of the most difficult, quite frankly. That entire arc was in response to that feeling that I think many of us have experienced, but I definitely went through when I was writing before this novel. Like those experiences kind of were what caused this novel, where there was the Freddie Gray incident and there was Trayvon Martin. And there are so many people, I can't even remember all the names. Like, and it was this period of almost every day there was a report of a new shooting. I had set up a Google Alerts at one point to try to keep track of things, and it started flooding my email box. And so I wanted to mirror that. And so writing those scenes was very difficult because it was forcing me to really face how often this thing happens and like the feeling that I kind of have when I, you know, you hear about these shootings and they just don't go away and you try to ignore them because you become overwhelmed, but they just don't go away. And that's where that kind of comes from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The title of your novel, Hell of a Book, reminds me of the great noir writer Jim Thompson's novel, A Hell of a Woman. And your narrator is a fan of film noir, and there are a few references to Fred McMurray and Double Indemnity. So I've got to ask, was A Hell of a Woman an influence on Hell of a Book in any way?
Unfortunately not. Like the genre, of course, is, but that particular work, unfortunately, isn't. It's funny, the title was not my option. It was not my choice at all. A little weird piece of trivia, I have yet to title any novel that I've written. Like, there's always an agent or an editor who comes up with a better title because I'm terrible at titles. So we had gotten pretty far in the process. My agent and I, we were about to start shopping it to publishers and we needed a title. I submitted a few and they were all really terrible. And my agent said, we should call it Hell of a Book. And I told her, I said, I don't want to do that because that's a very arrogant title for a book. Like if I went to a bookstore and I saw a book called Hell of a Book, I'd immediately walk past it because it's just like, how dare you be so presumptuous? And my agent said, no, it works because the novel has this running gag of like everyone says, oh, you wrote such a hell of a book. And then there's also just the fact that like the book is about the hell you go through in writing a book. So my agent's just stuck by our guns and somehow it worked.
Do you mind? Would you mind sharing a couple of the titles you had, or the terrible titles, or would you prefer not to?
I can't even really remember most of them. But they were just so bad. The full title of the book is "Hell of a Book" or "The Altogether Factual, Wholly Bonafide Story of a Big Dreams, Hard Luck, American-Made Mad Kid." That long, meandering, stuttering title is the one that I came up with. And I submitted to my agent and I said, okay, we can do your Hell of a Book title if you want, but I would love for the book to be so absurd that it has this really long, drawn out title And so the compromise was we would use that as like the interior flap.
So
that's kind of where my brain was at. I was pushing this absurdist route so hard that I think she wanted to dial it back a bit.
Right. I like your title though. I think it's good. It conjures images of, you know, sort of more of an old timey type story, kind of a Mark Twain story or a folktale or something. I want to get back to film noir for just a second. Do you see any connection between film noir and what it means to be black in America?
Yes and no. I do think that there's a bit of a connection because, you know, when you break down film noir, like it was so detached from reality. Film noir is a space where language functions in a very specific kind of way. Interactions, like it is so unique in how it represents itself. And I think that a lot of that is how, you know, America treats black culture. Black culture becomes this commodified thing there where people talk a certain way and they walk a certain way and they dance a certain way and all these things. So I think there's a parallel in that of how film noir is kind of viewed as this one-off genre. And I think that unfortunately a lot of black culture gets viewed as this one-off kind of thing that sits apart from American culture and American identity. So I think there's similarity there. But unfortunately, like during the period when film noir was being made and, you know, the genre was really big, black Americans weren't really allowed to be in those movies and to have those kinds of stories told through that lens of film noir, which would have been really beautiful and interesting at the time. But you didn't get many film noir stories with black characters doing anything. And so I think that's where there's a bit of a dissonance and disconnect that I would love to see, and which is what actually made the novel fun and interesting for me, because it was kind of, the novel was trying to send this message that like people don't think of black people as connecting with things like film noir or all these genres that we think of as like very much Americana. We don't oftentimes think of minorities and like young black kids somehow connecting with them. And they are, and they do. I mean, I grew up watching a lot of Japanese anime and like, you know, Westerns and Star Trek and like all those things as well. Then I discovered film noir later, and like film noir is really important to me and really fascinating to me. Like, I love the language and the cadence and the rhythm and everything about it. And there are others that I know that do as well, but you don't hear about that. So using that in the novel was really fun.
Yeah. One of the possible connections I saw between film noir and what it means to be black in America, and this isn't fair for me to say because I'm a white guy, but it seems to me that film noir is kind of my favorite film genre because of it's so existential. And it seems like the lives of black people, the systemic racism and everything, creates the same kind of tragic lives and tragic endings that you see in a lot of film noir. What do you think?
I think there's something to that. I think the only difference in that is that like so much of film noir is populated by people making very insidious decisions.
This is true. Good point. Yeah, very good point. Yeah.
They very much, film noir are very much like they come to ends of their own makings, so to speak. And I think that's one of the trademarks of film noir. Like, it's bad people doing bad things to other bad people. That sense of tragedy that does permeate a lot of film noir, because there's always the one good character who is somewhat innocent and kind of gets taken advantage of by the others. Like, there's some resonance in that for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks. But yeah, I really like what you had to say. Your ideas make much more sense than mine. We talked earlier about how with this book, your fourth novel, hell of a book, you were able to play with language in a way that you hadn't been able to before. Do you think that you'll be able to continue to play with language in your future work?
Yes, I am positive that I will. And like that was part of my goal for this. When we sold this novel, like my previous books were all done under contract to a publisher. And I'm not knocking the publisher by any means. Like, I love my previous publisher. I love my previous editor. But part of the separation from them just kind of came from the space of kind of creative differences. So I wrote this novel outside of contract, like was not owed to anyone. It was just a passion project that I had on my own, which is what gave me license to make it this weird, unique, strange, fun, dark thing that I wanted to make. Because there was no one to say, oh, you can't really do this, and that's not what I want. Like, it was just me having fun. And so when we sold the novel to my current publisher, the one stipulation that I told my agent that was a hard line deal breaker was, I said, this will be a one book deal. I said, I will never write under contract again. I said, from here on out, I'll just go off into the forest and write my books and then come back and find a publisher for them. We sold this to Dutton, who I've been absolutely in love with. Like, Dutton has been absolutely wonderful to me. But it was a one book deal. So right now I am not under contract to anyone. I can go write whatever I want and just find a home for it. And that's probably how the rest of my career will function. Mm-hmm. So the next novel that I write, I can make as playful as I want.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, you've got creative carte blanche. That's the way to go. Yeah. Jason Mott, thank you for joining us today. Congratulations on winning the National Book Award for Hell of a Book. It really is a hell of a book.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
Jason Mott is the author of Hell of a Book, the winner of the National Book Award for Fiction. Find out more at wpr.org/beta. Well, that does it for this edition of Beta. Thanks to our guests, Bob Odenkirk, Dana Schwartz, and Jason Mott. Beta is available to follow on Spotify or wherever you catch your favorite pods. And you can keep up with us during the week online at wpr.org/beta or on Twitter at @WPRBeta.
Even for the internet, it's pretty shocking.
Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
Fantastic.
Our music and technical director is Steve Gotcher.
If I had anything to do with it, I'm proud.
Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich.
Yeah, we were in town doing a show and we said, hey, let's go see Adam.
And thanks to you, our alphas. More Beta comes your way next week. Until then, I'm Doug Gordon.
That job was never the right fit for me. This is